good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 519 of Unwelcome Guests, The War on Sex. I'm Robin Upton. Strictly speaking, I should have called this program The War on Sexual Relationships, but I opted for brevity, and also because this suggested an obvious parallel with the war on drugs, which I shall be coming back to. In our second hour, we've got a range of presentations from Robert Jensen on internet pornography to Kenneth Doust on African puberty rights. But to begin with, we're looking at what is called child protection with, I think, about as much sincerity as what is called the war on terror. One of the first parallels that I'd like to suggest with the war on drugs is that both of them have had high media profiles, lots of shocking scare stories, and that this has been the focus rather than actual research and investigation by knowledgeable parties. So they are both, in one sense, a media spectacle which it claims to want the good for society but is basically insincere. I'm reminded of a magician who will make a flamboyant flourish with one hand whilst conjuring some magic in the other, and I think they are largely a distraction from many of the things which we look at regularly on the show. And of course, we should not forget that in a commercial environment, the more people that you can lock up, the more people who are employed to defend and investigate and even try and treat some of these cases, the more money is made. Now let's hear our first presentation by Judith Levine, speaking at the Bay Area Anarchist Book Fair in March 2009.
My name is Judith Levine, and among other books, I'm the author of Harmful to Minors, The Perils of Protecting Children from Sex, which you might have heard about some years back because it was widely attacked by the right. I was called an advocate of pedophilia. Just for the record, I'm not. I'm going to talk about kids, sex, and the state. Some of you are young enough to have lived through being teenagers during the worst sex panic in the last century in American history. And lucky for you, you're anarchists and you stay as far as you can from the state, because had you or your parents tried to enlist the help of, let's say, a child protective agency, you might be in juvenile detention even now or in adult prison. This is from a letter from a woman named Linda who lives in Texas. My son was watching another 13-year-old boy and his 10-year-old female cousin bumping each other fully dressed. My child was charged with sexual assault, as well as the other boy, because he did not tell the girl's mother what was happening. From a mother in Wisconsin, mother of a boy named Joe, 14 years old, a police sergeant indicated that the sex was consensual. My son was very frightened as the detective was shouting at him and had a gun. He did not write a confession. The detective wrote it for him. Approximately 2 weeks later, we received papers in the mail indicating that he was being charged with second-degree sexual assault. Justin Wilson, age 10, in Texas. Justin's stepmother caught him and his 5-year-old brother looking at each other naked. They were comparing peepees. Justin was given 1 year probation. He had to complete crisis counseling, and he was required to register as a sex offender for 10 years. Shannon, boy in California. The reason for placement was a sexual offense done when I was 13 in California. Basically, I engaged in consensual sexual acts with three neighbor boys, 13, 11, and 8. Treatment involved putting a rubber band appearing contraption hooked up through a computer around your penis, and you sat in a dark room with your pants to your ankles and listened to various audio recordings. These testimonials come from a website called Ethical Treatment for All Youth. I recommend you look at it. It's managed by a smart, compassionate young guy named Jeff Berkey. Some of the subscribers to this, it has a listserv also. Some of them are people like me, journalists, sex radicals, researchers. But most of them are people like Linda and Shannon. They're ordinary Americans, and a lot of them are conservative people or even Christians, and they've just found themselves caught in a terrible web of the law. I sometimes think of this site as 100 years from now is going to be a great primary resource for people just like me, or say Michel Foucault, or you know, great journalists like Nellie Bly. But at the moment, it functions as this cri de coeur of people who have found themselves victims of a crazy, tragic time in American social and legal history. In 2002, I wrote this book, Harmful to Minors, and it argued that the things that we do in America to try to protect children from sex are way, way more harmful to them than sex itself, which is actually a great part of growing up, with, you know, attendant heartbreaks and all the rest of it, but just like all of growing up, and that the things we do, such as criminalize kids' sexuality or put them into jail or put them in psychological counseling or giving them abstinence-only education, these things are really terribly, have grave consequences for kids. I wish I could say that that book made a difference in a positive direction, but it didn't. Things have gotten way worse since 2002. Since that time, almost every single state in the union has vigorously strengthened their sex crime statutes. One thing they've done in almost every state is to impose a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence on what's called the aggravated sexual assault of a child. Aggravated means that the child, the minor, is a certain age. It doesn't really have anything to do with the coercion or the violence of the act. Since 2002, many more states have also instituted civil commitment. That means after you finish a sentence for sexual offense, you can be put into a mental institution similar to those they had in, Stalinist Russia for the rest of your life until a shrink says it's okay to let you out. And all of these things have been upheld as constitutional. Very recently, the Supreme Court decided that it was unconstitutional to execute a person for a sexual offense against a child. This was really the first time that anything had been found too cruel and unusual when the offender did a sex crime. And both presidential candidates, including Barack Obama, said they were disappointed with the ruling. But the biggest change since 2002 is the 2007 Adam Walsh Child Protection Act. The main thing that the Child Protection Act does is it sets up this gigantic national sex offender registry, and it requires that states enhance sex offender registry requirements. Among those things is that everyone who does a sexual offense from the age 14 and above must be put on a sex offender registry for at least 10 years. These laws are intended to protect children from sexual exploitation, but they disproportionately affect teenagers. The age group with by far the largest number of convictions for sex offenders are people between 14 and 20 years old. These are almost all of them consensual acts of sex between kids with somebody who's about 2 or 3 years younger than them. There are 19,000 minors on sex offender registries nationally. 19,000. Some of these people are as young as 11 years old. You can go to the sex offender registries of Georgia or Kentucky or Alabama or even northern states like Ohio, Illinois, and you can see these peach fuzz children on sex offender registries. What did they do? They played doctor with their little brother. That's what they did. It's not that no minor ever commits a violent rape. They do that. But for the most part, these are, as I said, statutory rape. In almost every state in the union, in every state of the union, if you have sex and you are a minor, you are likely committing a felony. I will repeat this. If you are 16 in the state of Georgia and have sex with another 16-year-old person, you are committing a felonious act. You can be put in juvenile detention, and after that, you can be put into adult prison, and after that, you will be on a sex offender registry. And once you're on a sex offender registry, your life is effectively over. You cannot get a job. You cannot live in most places. You cannot go into the military. You cannot get into college. You cannot get a loan for a college. You can live almost nowhere because there are these residency restrictions. You can't really have a relationship or have a family because you're not allowed to be near children, ever, really. Even your own children, should you have them. These laws are very easy to get on the books. No amount of facts will stop them. Every time one of these laws come up, and now these have been on the books for a long time, several decades, so there's a lot of evidence that shows that they really don't protect anyone. They don't stop crime. If they did that, they might be better. I mean, I'm not big on sending anybody to prison, but they don't. Each time the ACLU comes out and shouts a little, sometimes the public defender's office will send in a witness, and there are usually witnesses, researchers, who say this really doesn't protect any kid, and it really, and there are many, you know, what would be considered to be unintended consequences. I would argue that they are in some ways intended, such as sex offenders who live in states and places with residency restrictions. Really, many of them are homeless now. In Florida, there was a really extraordinary demonstration by homeless sex offenders who were living under a bridge. They called in the media and had a press conference under this bridge. Shortly after that, one of them was killed in an accident. He was decapitated by a tractor trailer because he was living right next to a highway. And then, of course, former sex offenders on registries are not uncommonly the victims of vigilante violence, and sometimes they're killed, and not infrequently they kill themselves. And minors are most likely to kill themselves because they look forward to not much of a life. Most people look at this and they say, good, they deserve it. They should be killed or kill themselves. But even those legislatures that do understand that these laws are unjust and they don't really work to help kids will vote for them. A guy who was a lobbyist for the American Family Association told me in the 1990s, he said, when the Senate votes on child issues, they're all on one side. If the law has the word child in it, even if it has nothing to do with children, he said, it was a slam dunk. And the way sex panics work is that once you have more laws, you have more enforcement. When you have more enforcement, you have more arrests. What the laws do is they generally broaden the definition of a crime so that, for instance, it used to be child pornography to take a picture of somebody who was under 12. They didn't really find enough child pornography, and they had this big machine to, you know, go out and arrest people. So then they made it 14, and then still not quite enough, 16 and now 18. So you broaden the definition of the crime. You get more cops. You make more arrests. Soon people are feeling like, gosh, there's a lot of crime. There's a perception of more crime, and so they start to clamor for more laws. And once they're on the books, they're almost impossible to get off the books. The sodomy laws that were passed in Britain in the 1860s and 70s, and, you know, would go through long periods of quiescence. Nobody would enforce them. And then, you know, there would be a time of particular repression, such as during the 1950s, and they start to round up queers. It took 100 years to get those laws off the books, and it required a serious, large social movement, the gay liberation movement, to get them off the books. There's no political capital in standing up and saying, I want to repeal a sex crimes law, and so nobody does it. For instance, is another interesting way that, you know, these laws sitting around can be used. In Kansas recently, the anti-abortion people exhumed this 1887 law, which allows citizens to impanel a grand jury pretty much against anybody they want to. And there's this poor guy called George Tiller. He's a doctor, and he does abortions in late term. And so the Kansas anti-abortion movement has been after this poor guy for decades. They shot him in both arms. I mean, they've done everything to him. So they impaneled this thing, and then they went fishing, and they wanted 2,000 records of every woman who'd ever had an abortion in his clinic. Luckily, you know, some pro-choice people came in and fought this thing. But that's just a way of saying that here's this law sitting around for more than 100 years, and at any time you can take it up and use it for a repressive purpose. Increasingly, though, what the states are doing is not just punishing people for, I guess, what could be considered unconventional sex. Although I would say that, you know, being 16 and having sex is hardly unconventional. It's kind of all you do when you're 16. That's how I did, to be 16 again. But they are not just punishing people, and especially minors, for sex. They're curing them. This conflation of punishment and cure also goes back a long time. If you haven't read Foucault, I really recommend that you do. It's been just overlapping, first with this kind of religious cure and now with psychological cures. And so you have this kind of what the psychologist Paul Okami calls a slippage of different definitions of criminal, psychological, and moral categories of sexual abuse, or as they call it. And once you start to put these two things together, there's a really twisted logic. It's a tautology. It kind of circles around and around on itself. So here's how it goes. According to therapists, you know, sex abuse therapists, prosecutors, police, and some journalists, even some parents, the behavior that kids are doing is wrong. It's wrong because it's illegal. Well, why is it illegal? Well, it's illegal because it's wrong. Now, it's illegal also because it's harmful. Why is it harmful? You know, you ask, well, you know, are kids really harming? Well, one of the reasons it's harmful is that it's illegal and you can get arrested for it. Prosecutors will sometimes say, you know, they arrest these two kids, they've been having sex together. Well, you know, what they did, it's not really that bad, the guy will say. In fact, it's normal what they're doing. So why did you arrest him? Well, we arrested him because it's against the law. So why is it against the law? Then again, they say, because it's harmful. But if it's normal and everyone does it, how can it possibly be harmful? Everybody would be a basket case. You know, everyone has sex when they're a kid. Well, actually, they'll say, it's not really harmful, and it's not really, it really is normal, but it is wrong. So now we have the moral thing. Parents don't like their teenagers having sex, they'll say. Most parents don't. And anyway, you know, a lot of kids don't know it's illegal. So now there's a new effort to go out and tell kids it's illegal. This is a new thing they're doing in sex ed, is to tell them, watch out, you might get arrested. Anyway, and another reason that it's harmful is that other kids might ostracize them. Why? Because they might get arrested. So, you know, it just goes on and on and on like this. But the really, really pernicious part of this is once you start to cure kids, there's a whole industry of doing sex. It's called sex offense therapy, sex abuse therapy. You know, the whole idea of offender treatment is already a conflation of these two agendas, the punishment agenda and the treatment agenda. The conflated terms, these conflated terms are just, they're the lingua franca of the entire, there's really a whole abuse industry. The likes, for instance, there's a group called the National Adolescent Perpetrator Network, which just had a task force, and they put out these standards of what they call sexual molestation. A criminologist named Frank Zimring did a really great book called An American Travesty, and he takes all this stuff apart, and he said, according to this task force, a majority of American men and boys have committed multiple acts of child molestation by the time they reach their 21st birthday. This aggregation of such behavior into one single category, child molestation, is an extraordinary abuse for an organization of therapists. So what do they do with kids when they're in this therapy? The first axiom of it is that the therapist is not really there as a therapist on the side of the patient. The patient is actually seen as a kind of an antagonist because he has broken the law. And the therapist's confederate is not the person in the room with them, but the law, the prosecutor. So anything, first of all, that the kid says to the therapist can and is used against him. The therapist is called a mandatory reporter. That means if they hear anything, let's say the kid's having a fantasy of going out and having sex with another 15-year-old, then that therapist has to tell the jailers. In fact, I've heard therapists say, well, these kids are all liars. So they don't believe them. They don't trust them. They think they're an enemy of the public, and they're criminals. What they do in these therapies is they make the kids rehearse over and over, confess the molestation that they've done, the fantasies that they have, the times they've masturbated, the times, you know, should they be so lucky to actually have sex, the times they've had sex. They have to tell new people over and over, a new therapist, a new prosecutor, a new board of psychologists, and they're supposed to also reveal it to anyone that they might be thinking of having a relationship with. So that kind of cuts off the possibility of them kind of moving on out of this thing. And, you know, what do they learn from it? As one kid who went through this said, I learned that sex is bad. The assumptions of this system about sex and the protection of innocence and the dangerousness of sex offenders and about the appropriateness of sex, of state intervention in the sex lives of minors, either through criminalization or through this pathologizing of teen sex, these assumptions are so widespread, so hegemonic, that even those people who critique the system use its own logic to do so. So, for instance, the main arguments against sex offender registries and residency restrictions is they don't work to keep sex offenders under surveillance. So the idea is they, number one, they should be under surveillance, and these laws are not really working to do that. And so, for instance, you have these Florida guys living under the bridge. It is true that many, many former sex offenders, you know, if you're on a sex offender registry, like every time you move, every time you get a car, every time you enroll in school or get a new job or anything, you have to report to them within 24 hours to 3 days. And it's just really hard to do it. And you can't live within 50 yards of a bus stop or within, you know, a half a mile of a school or, you know, and there are many towns in which there really is no place you can live. If it's a small town, there's no place you can live. So they disappear from the system. And police don't like this because they can't keep track of them. The police also don't like it because they do have to keep track of them. They have GPS devices on them, and then the GPS device beeps, and then the cops have to go out and find them, and they can't go out and stop any real crime. And so it's a big pain in the ass for the cops, which we might all applaud in this room. But the main argument against mandatory minimum sentences is that they take away the prosecutor's ability to do a plea bargaining. The case has to go to trial, and because especially statutory rape cases are really very hard to get a conviction on, it's much better to get somebody to plea that the alleged victim, because she actually was a consensual player in the sex, won't testify. So the closer you get to trial, the harder it's going to be for the prosecution to get a conviction. So prosecutors have come out against these 25-year mandatory minima because they know they're going to lose. So that's another one of these ways in which the argument is really everybody's on the prosecution side. Even I've heard public defenders make the same argument. Hey, you're not going to be able to get a plea. I think these are kind of strategic, but they're bad strategy because, you know, we anarchists know that you want to go for what you really want, not for what you think you're going to get, because you end up getting what, you know, the other side really wants. And the argument against putting kids in jail and on sex offender registries is that it's unnecessary because treatment works. That's what they say, treatment works. Teens, it turns out, have the lowest recidivism rate of any class of sex offenders. Well, it's obvious to me why they have a low recidivism rate. The reason is they get out of jail and they're no longer minors. So they are statutorily unable to commit the crime for which they were put in jail in the first place. Some of the really twisted arguments come from liberals. In Massachusetts a few months ago, a bunch of kids were having sex, and boys and girls, and the boys were all prosecuted and the girls were not prosecuted. Well, the ACLU came along and they said, this is sex discrimination. Now, they didn't say the boys should not be prosecuted. They said the girls should also be prosecuted along with the boys because that would be much fairer. Then along comes Wendy Murphy, who's a lawyer who I can only describe as a feminist man-hater of the old school. I know I used to be one. And she says, no, the boys should only be prosecuted because boys have more power than girls. And if you've ever been a teenage girl, you know that is not true. The criminalization of teen sex is only the most extreme edge of a spectrum in the ways in which the state tries to protect kids by punishing them. The other things you could say really affect a lot more kids much more broadly and maybe in even a longer term way. And one of these things is abstinence-only education, which the federal government has spent $1.5 billion on since 1982. That's when they first passed what was called the chastity law. It's the only money the federal government has ever in history put into sex education or sex, I always call it no sex education. And guess what? It didn't work either. Kids didn't stop having sex. And in fact, teen pregnancy is up in 26 states. But that's true that actually live births to women who get pregnant are up in all ages of women. And that's also true that teens don't act differently in terms of pregnancy, abortion, and having babies. They don't act very much differently from adult women. In fact, one of the things I say in Harmful to Minors is that kids are really not all that different from adults when it comes to sex. Kids have sex for the same reasons adults do. it feels good. They like the person. It gives them status. They're doing some sort of negotiation. I mean, this is like a lot of reasons to have sex. And kids and adults more or less do the same thing. And then there was also this great study that was done about 10 years ago about people's emotional age. And it turns out like 90% of people have an emotional age of about 17, no matter how old they are. So Peter Pan was right. You never grow up. Abstinence only is still on, even though we have a new administration and things may be changing. It's still any government website you go to, there is that's for kids or for parents about kids. There is no information on there about contraception, about condoms, about really even about AIDS prevention. It's just about abstinence, almost all about abstinence. And of course, abortion, limits on young women having abortions. There are 16 states that have no parental consent or parental notification. And some states require the woman to notify both of her parents, whether she lives with them or not. And in two states, she has to get the consent of both parents. Abortion politics has really colonized everything about sex statute. You know, Title X family planning was cut back, mainly under pressure from anti-abortion people. And, you know, some of this stuff I think is going to be repealed. It's going to be overturned. Already the global gag law, that was the law that prohibits anybody in a country that gets U.S. aid for family planning to even mention abortion to patients. That was overturned by Obama on the first day. So there's some good faith and some good news, maybe. In 2005, they cut back all the money. This is an example for kids. All the subsidies that went to kids getting college health services, and that included birth control. You used to be able to get birth control cheap at a college, and now you can. And the stimulus package tried to restore that, which gives new meaning and optimistic meaning to the word stimulus. So, you know, you may not go to jail for sex if you're a kid, but you will certainly end up ill-educated. The good thing is there's a lot of ways to get an education about sex, and I think school is the last place you do it. But, you know, when I think about where this state might have some role, look in places like Nigeria or Brazil, where the state has actually funded some very, very good HIV prevention and sex education programs, which come to it from just a sort of facts-only, unmoralistic point of view. I wrote this talk a few days ago, and I was going to say that the one silver lining maybe on the McCain-Palin side of the Obama victory was that probably Bristol and Levi would not have to get married. And then I read in the paper this morning that Bristol and Levi are not getting married. So I think he was a bad seed anyway. But, you know, as Tina Fey said to her, the definition of a marriage was a sacred bond between two unwilling teenagers. So why is all this happening? You know, people always say, well, you know, why are we so fucked up about sex? You know, to tell you the truth, I don't know. I really don't know. Because, you know, you go anywhere else in the world and people, they're really flabbergasted by us. You know, people say, well, we're all Puritans or the right wing is against sex. Now, that's really not true. You know, go to these Christian websites and they teach you all kinds of ways of having sex, you know, and you just have to do it when you're married. But take it from me, you can do anything. I mean, really, right, Liz? You know, you've read these. You can do anything if you're a Christian, just as long as you, you know, think of God while you're doing it. You know, we are Puritans and then we're not Puritans. You know, I think probably the strongest holdover from the sexual liberation movements of the 60s and 70s is the widespread acceptance of pornography. You know, it makes sense that in capitalism, the way, you know, you could commercialize the social movement, and that's what has lasted. And it lasted also for kids. I mean, kids, you know, have really adopted, I think, pornographic conventions in their sexual styles, and I don't really have anything against it. But I thought I would apply a kind of an anarchist analysis to, you know, why does this keep on happening? I think it's the anarchist idea that the state needs to justify itself in order to perpetuate itself works really well when you're thinking about surveillance, moral surveillance. You pass these laws, these bureaucracies get set up. And not just bureaucracies in the government, but there are NGOs on the side, and then there's professional organizations, and there's therapists and all the rest, and then there's the prison industrial complex. And then they need to have a reason to exist. So they have to do that both in their actions. They actually have to arrest a lot of people, and they also have to do it ideologically, discursively, like that, you know, that it is wrong, and you need to, the culture needs to change for people to feel that this stuff really is wrong and it really is harmful. And so that by this time, it's really hard to find a parent who says, sure, of course my kids are going to have sex. You know, I want them to use birth control. I don't want them to get any sexually transmitted diseases, but this is wonderful. I mean, this is part of the great pleasure of being a kid, and they'll stumble and they'll learn, you know. So it's really rare to find that, you know, and it's really even rare to find it among progressive parents. Maybe some of you are progressive parents and you'll be better about this. And also the ideological forces that try to repress sex are flexible. So they're able to kind of change the target. You know, in the 80s, the big target of protection, the object of protection, were women. And so there was a whole, you know, anti-porn movement at that moment. Well, it didn't really take hold. People didn't sign on to it. There were two anti-porn ordinances that tried to pass in the Midwest in the 1980s. Both of them were found unconstitutional. And so the advocates of censorship didn't just roll over and die. They changed their strategies, and they really started to home in on kids, on protecting kids from sex. There was no adult left. You know, no homosexual, no adults were saying, look, it's consensual, leave me alone. I mean, I would accept from this the really great feminist victory of taking rape seriously, understanding that this really is a crime and you have to listen to women. And I've since really become a prison abolitionist. I don't think it really helps to put people in jail, but it would help, to, you know, but sometimes people who do very bad things need to be somewhere where they're not going to hurt people. But at least to understand that rape is a cultural crime, let's call it that. But the advocates of censorship, I did a little sort of catalog of how they changed their names, because I think it was kind of interesting when they went from protecting what they called decency to protecting children. So the Citizens for Decency Through Law, this was an organization that was founded in 1957 by a paragon of decency through law, Charles Keating, who was the savings and loan swindler, those of you who are old enough to remember. That the Citizens for Decency Through Law became the Children's Legal Foundation, and then that changed its name to the National Family Legal Foundation. Reverend Donald Wildman, you may remember him, American Family Association. The American Family Association was previously called the National Federation for Decency, and then it got the word family in it. The National Coalition Against Pornography spun off into the National Law Center for Children and Families. And the Justice Department's National Obscenity Enforcement Unit, this was set up by the Mies Commission in the 1980s, was rechristened the Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section. I like the name of that one because it sounds like its purpose is the exploitation of children, the Child Exploitation Section. You know, send her in there, we'll exploit her, or over there. So then they set up this vast surveillance for child pornography. And as I said before, it was hard for them to find enough child pornography. So they kept on widening the net. They brought in these vigilante groups like Perverted Justice. Remember, some of you might have watched To Catch a Predator. Still couldn't get enough people. So then they also started to say that a morphed image, a cartoon, an image in which there is no actual child being used to create pornography, was also criminal. And then I just recently helped a couple in Kansas City who were arrested for child pornography. The woman brought in some pictures to get them put on a CD. They said these were child pornographic images. And when their lawyer finally looked at the images, they turned out to be pictures of naked Ken dolls. And it turned out that the kid had taken them. By this time, their children had been taken out of their home and kept away from them for 4 months. And here's a really good new wrinkle. Kids are being arrested for taking naked pictures of themselves. This is called sexting. Some of you know about this. And sending them on their cell phones to their friends. So not only the person can be a perpetrator and a victim of child pornography production at the same time. Ain't the criminal justice system grand? I mean, and not only the kids, but then the friends who receive the images, who might be their friends or their boyfriends or girlfriends, they're now in possession. So the first kid is the producer and the distributor, and the second kid is possessor. This happened in Greensburg, Pennsylvania recently. The kids, three girls, 14 and 15, their boyfriends were 16 and 17. And the police captain, George Saranko, described the obscenity of the images this way. He said, "They weren't just breasts. They showed female anatomy." Similar sexting prosecutions have taken place in Alabama, Connecticut, Florida, New Jersey, New York, Michigan, Ohio, Texas, and Utah at last count. But there was a survey done of kids about their online behavior, and in this survey, which I think was kind of self-selected, but one out of five kids said they had done sexting. So that's 20% of kids are now like doing some sort of a crime. Being caught for child pornography is no small thing. It is a federal crime, and the penalties for it are four times higher in general than they are for murder. So if a kid gets prosecuted for one of these things, they are in deep trouble, and as with all sex crimes, they will be on a sex offender registry afterwards. The criminalization of teen sex is very good for prisons and juvenile detention centers, many of which are private, an increasing number of them are private. From 1985 to 1995, youth detention grew 72% in America. And now that we have the highest number percentage of people in our country incarcerated in the whole world, that number has, I'm sure, grown higher, but that was the latest national survey that was taken. It's good for corruption. Whenever there's money, it's good for government corruption. It's a sort of private-public, hybrid. Recently in Pennsylvania, two judges were charged with receiving kickbacks of $2.6 million over 4 years for sentencing kids to juvenile detention. And these places are really torturous. I mean, kids have died in them. You know, they're out in the desert, in the sun, and they collapse and die. One of these kids who was sent by this Pennsylvania judge had committed the crime of putting up a Facebook page making fun of one of her teachers. So, what can we do about this? I think people in this room would probably agree that the state should stay out of consensual sex altogether, kids or adults, or that the state should just disappear. But since the state is not about to disappear, I thought as I was coming over here, I'm an anarchist, and failing that, I want there to be a big government that just redistributes the wealth and does good stuff, stays out of wars and all that. But, is there any role for the state in kids' sex lives? I said this before, that there might be ways of doing education that could be helpful. And, there's a difference between education or information and intervention. In one case, you give facts and let people do with what they want, but with them what they want. But, as for these crimes of passion, I've really thought a long, hard time. I've been working on these issues for decades, and really things have only gotten worse, and I feel despairing about it. I don't know how it's going to change, and this is how I think the only way it's going to change is that it's going to get worse before it gets better. What you see in these listservs that I started out with, there's these groups, they're called Save Our Tech Sons. Turns out, in Texas, there's really a disproportionate amount of conviction. This is true in California, too, of Chicanos and Mexicans for having consensual relationships, because it's pretty common, especially among working class and poor Mexicans, to have relationships in which the men are quite a bit older than the women. And so you have an underage woman. She's got a baby with a guy. They have a family, and then they send the guy to jail, and now she's on welfare. So it's really interesting when you look at the names of people under surveillance in the state of California. There are a huge number of Hispanic names. So these people get pulled into this thing. They're really astonished that the state could do this to their kids. It's completely heartbreaking. They've lost their children. They've lost their family. They've lost every penny they've got. Their families are shamed in their neighborhoods. They have to move. And they get radicalized by it. Anybody who's ever been picked up for, letting his dog drink water out of the fountain and has to go to jail or something, it's the most radicalizing experience you could possibly have, is to be on the other side of that gate. Once you are arrested, you are no longer human. Probably a lot of people have done civil disobedience in this room, and you get arrested, and it's really, I think everybody should be arrested in this country, because they would really understand what it feels like to be dehumanized from the get-go. A lot of states now are... Vermont, I live there part of the time, they just passed a law that allows the police to take DNA from you when you're arrested, not when you're indicted. And so the state now is collecting up a database of everybody's DNA. And then they say they're going to expunge it, they're going to get rid of it if you're exonerated. Yeah, you wish. So I think that, you know, in order for this kind of thing to change, you know, politics is not really rational. It's an emotional thing. Social movements are mobilized by feeling. And once people start to have this tragic experience, I mean, I hope that this will, you know, start to change them, to make them understand the way this stuff works. And, you know, more and more families, more and more friends will have this stuff in their life, and finally they may say enough. And I can tell you that we're probably getting to that point fast, because I'll leave you with this statistic. At present, one out of every 220 American men is under surveillance of the criminal justice system in one way or another for a sex offense. So we're all criminals. Thank you.
I don't see that one out of 220 people is everybody, but certainly Judith Naveen in that presentation makes a good point about the huge overreaction to child sexual experience. Even the word abuse, which I nearly said then, is to make a value judgment. And a lot of this, if you check your history, is behavior which in other times and other cultures was considered anything but deviant. So why pass a lot of laws to criminalize behavior like sexting and then give kids mobile phones and act surprised when they break those laws? The first parallel that springs to my mind is internet piracy, so-called. People who click on files and download them to their computer are being likened to other people who board ships, kill people, throw people overboard just by use of the term piracy. But the point about making everything is illegal, everybody is a criminal, so everybody has something to hide, and everybody has something to fear. As an example of how this could be used politically, consider the case of Scott Ritter, who's featured several times on this show, making some very principled and serious objections to the war in Iraq. Now, the people involved in that act of mass murder have not been brought to trial. However, resources have been brought to bear to catch Mr. Ritter in a police sting, first in 2001, on two occasions, and now in 2009. He was due to stand trial this month, but apparently that's been postponed, for the heinous crime of exposing himself to a police officer via a webcam on his computer, when, and this is a point of contention, police claim that he was notified that the person in question was a 15-year-old girl, and he denies that. Now, you might say that was fairly foolish of him, considering he was nearly caught in a similar fashion 8 years ago. But I wonder how many people actually see it in that light. At the website where I'm reading this, there's a lot of expletives, people typing in capital letters, and they're clearly very emotionally invested in the fact that because he's been charged as a paedophile, he's therefore less than human and not worthy even of being deemed innocent until proven guilty. Now, this is a remarkable echo of the war on terror, whereby because terror is such a heinous crime, anyone charged with terror is not worthy of legal defences which have centuries of pedigree. So it's the same thing. It's people being controlled sufficiently through the mass media to operate on a basis of fear, to suspend their critical judgment, for people to think like an infant that the only important judgment is that made by the responsible adult, or in this case, the metaphorical responsible adult, which, remembering George Lakoff's strict father model, is the national government. Obviously, somewhat more functional consideration of this would reveal that, because the government is a hierarchy, this is to invest ordinary human beings with unlimited power, which almost everybody, in a sober reflection, would note is not a good thing. But of course, the ramping up of the ante is designed to prevent sober reflection. I don't know how many political opponents of the powers that be have been caught with drugs on them at an airport somewhere, but that's pretty easy to set up, as opposed to a victimful crime. And of course, in these days in which you can raid somebody's house or look at their computer, even over the internet, probably, if you've got a team of hackers. But you're allowed to legally break into somebody's house while they're not there and find some pornographic pictures on their computer, then it becomes a very simple matter to remove somebody from a position of active opposition. You can even do this, bring a legal action, and then suspend it ad infinitum, provided they don't rock the boat. So, in other words, like the war on terror or the war on drugs, because it abridges the normal legal process and has an associated fear gambit to suspend people's rational contemplation, then it's a tool which can be used to keep people in line. Now let's return to Judith Levine, some questions and answers, and the questions are largely not audible, so I've just cut them, but Judith Levine thoughtfully summarizes the question on several occasions.
Some are asked, is the list of sex offenders 100% male? No, but it is largely male. And for instance, if, say, there are two kids who are having sex, or two people, it's mostly like, if you're male, go to jail, is what they say. So the older partner and or the boy or man is much more likely to be prosecuted, but that's not 100%. And also in cases of same-sex sex, both boys may be prosecuted. There are fewer prosecutions of lesbian girls. I think it's just more because lesbian girls just don't tell anybody, or parents don't get upset. That's another thing, is one of the ways that people get into the system is like a mother walks in and she sees her kids playing, you know, sexually in the bathtub or something. She gets worried, and so she calls a therapist. The therapist or the Child Protection Agency is a mandatory reporter. They go and they say, we have suspicion of sexual abuse, and before you know it, these kids are in treatment or taken away from their homes. So that's another thing. Don't go to the state if you have a problem with your kid. Yes. And what you said was that all of this surveillance really obscures the real issues of power and violence and sex. And I agree with you. And she's saying we need to have realistic conversations with kids about really negotiating, you know, how do you have relationships? How do you have sex? It's not just the boy is more powerful all the time or the older person, whatever it is, but just how do you think about that stuff? And how do you have some sense of yourself so that you can say no or yes? And that stuff's not happening at all, because as this boy learned in treatment, sex is bad. And I think kids are learning that in different ways. Yeah. He said if a child under 10 starts, what did you say? Comes interested in sex with an adult. My feeling is that children under 10 don't have any power with adults, and that in any relation, any kind of sexual interaction between a 10-year-old child and an adult, the adult is the one who's responsible. I don't know that person should go to jail for 30 years, but that person is responsible. This is Carol Queen, sexandculture.org. Check it out. Joey. Joey asked about, in the 1980s, there was this hysteria about so-called satanic ritual abuse of children. It was completely invented. 15, 20 years later, the FBI and local prosecutors did a massive, massive investigation of there being any evidence of any kind of satanic abuse of children, and there was zero, none. There are still dozens of people in jail in this country on charges of satanic ritual abuse, and they are still making these charges. There's a case in Texas that just happened, and it's kind of resurging, and they call it cult abuse now because satanic got a bad name. Satan had really got a bad name. Not in this crowd, maybe. It was an exaggeration of the fantasy of, it began in daycare centers because I think people were anxious, you know, that women were at work and their children were in daycare. And so here were the people who were like making life possible for families, these women working in daycare centers, and they were the ones who were being accused, and the bus drivers and everyone else. So it has sort of morphed a little bit. And what we see, I'm on the board of the National Center for Reason and Justice, ncrj.org. It's an organization that helps people that have been falsely accused of sex, mostly sex crimes, but crimes against children. And what we see is much more ordinary kinds of allegations of abuse. Nothing, no kangaroos, no swords, no black candles, no robes, none of that. Just my husband did it, my wife did it, the guy down the street did it. Let me be clear. There is sexual abuse against of children, and some of these are real allegations, but are real charges, and some of them are not. A lot of them are not. The bizarreness has sort of disappeared, except it does flare up here and there. Well, you know, I think this is a dialectic. I mean, I don't think that the state is separate from the people. Laws are just one expression of cultural anxieties. They're the reification of cultural anxiety. And as I said before, that once you have the law, that helps to perpetuate the cultural anxiety. So it feeds on itself. Homophobia hasn't gone away, as we know. Prop 8 passed in California. The protection of children and dangers to children are, to me, a very logical place to feel anxious because, let's face it, the world is not very friendly to children. And I'm going to just end by saying one last thing, and that is, you know, a lot of these laws to protect children are being done in place of things that the state could do to protect children. A child from a family that earns less than $15,000 a year is 22 times more likely to be abused, battered, neglected, unloved, or sexually molested by her family than a child whose family earns more than $30,000 a year. So the single thing that the state could do to protect children, not just from everything, but from specifically from sexual abuse, is to help families have the wherewithal to feed, clothe, and adequately love and care for their children. Poor people are not evil, but they are under much greater stresses. They tend to be younger parents. They live in crowded housing where lots of people move in and out. And these are things that make children vulnerable to abuse. And so to help kids be less poor would make them much more safe sexually. Thanks a lot.
I hope Judith Levine's presentation allowed you to see a new angle on why child abuse has popped out of the woodwork as such an important thing that the media is spending such a lot of time on. Like the national security and military police establishment, who are simultaneously making money out of forbidding drugs and making money out of running drugs, or the national security state, who take a lot of money to protect people from the same terrorists that they fund or set up or just carry out false flags under the name of. Seems to me there's an element of double dipping going on in the war on sexual relationships. Of course, the powers that be, who decide what is going to be on the media or legal agenda, don't need money because they control the banks. What do they need is power. What they feel they need is power anyway. So how do they get that power through a scheme like this? Well, promoting fear puts people in a different mindset. They're inclined to follow leaders without such hesitation. They're inclined to be mistrustful of anything that they've been told is likely to be a danger, such as other people. If you're a child, adults become dangerous in this climate. If you're an adult, children become dangerous because it could be a source of lawsuits. And to make that clear, here's an article from a UK national daily from October 2009.
Council bans parents from play areas. Parents have been banned from supervising their children in public playgrounds because they have not undergone criminal record checks. Only council-vetted play rangers are now allowed to monitor youngsters in two adventure areas in Watford, while parents must watch from outside a perimeter fence. The Watford Borough Council policy has been attacked as insulting and a disgrace by furious relatives who say they are being labelled as potential paedophiles. It will further fuel concerns over a growing nanny state amid the deepening row over the government's new national anti-paedophile database. That will see at least 11 million adults have to be vetted to work with children or vulnerable adults, including parents who give officials lifts to and from social or sports clubs. Councillors in Watford claim that they are only following government guidelines and cannot allow adults to walk around playgrounds unchecked. But Ofsted dismissed the ban while parents branded it a joke. The rules have been imposed at Harwood's and Harebrake's adventure recreation grounds. Activities on the half-acre site include a skateboard half-pipe, a zip line, rope swings, den building, arts and crafts, plus a wide range of indoor and outdoor sports activities. Play rangers currently patrol both parks, which are specifically for children aged 5 to 15, and are fully qualified and have been cleared by the Criminal Records Bureau. Parents already have to register their child on arrival at the free playgrounds so staff can have their contact details in the event of an accident. But now only those who have been vetted by the Criminal Records Bureau, by the council, can enter the sites, which are surrounded by 6-foot-high steel and wooden fences. Mother of five, Marcella Bergin, 35, has been visiting with her three eldest children for many years without any problems. She said, "It's like they're branding all parents potential paedophiles, which is disgraceful. 99% of people are great parents and certainly not child abusers. The whole thing is just a joke, and I will certainly not be adhering to the new rules, which frankly are crazy." Mo Mills, 62, a retired youth worker who has 6 grandchildren, added, "This is typical of the nanny state and I am furious. The council should hang their head in shame at this political correctness gone mad." Mum of 8, Jenny Abbasi, 41, said, "I find it insulting that the council are essentially branding everyone paedophiles and telling us we cannot be trusted with our own kids. It's a disgrace." Claude Knights, the founder of children's charity Kidscape, said the council were using sledgehammer to crack nuts. They are encouraging a climate where parents and children are rendered suspicious without any proof of wrongdoing or guilt, she said. Caring parents should not be viewed as a threat, and if you are a bona fide parent or carer, you are in a better position to look after your children than council staff. A council notice to parents explains that, quote, "Safeguarding the children and young people who use the site is one of our top priorities. Due to Ofsted regulations, we have a responsibility to ensure that every authorized adult who enters our site is properly vetted and given a Criminal Records Bureau check by Watford Borough Council," unquote. Council Mayor Dorothy Thornhill argued that they are merely enforcing government policy at the play areas. She said, quote, "Sadly, in today's climate, you can't have adults walking around unchecked in a children's playground, and the adventure playground is not a meeting place for adults. We have reviewed our procedures, so although previously some parents have stayed with their children at the discretion of our play workers, this is not something we can continue to do. There are other places in the town for parents with small children to go," unquote. But a spokesman for Ofsted said, quote, "Ofsted would never seek to prevent parents and carers having access to their own children. We would not insist that each parent must have a member of staff with them all times. Many settings operate very well with parents and carers present, and indeed this can be an important part of the young children settling somewhere new," unquote. The Daily Telegraph disclosed on Tuesday how employers will come under pressure to register staff with the government's anti-paedophile database, even if they have little contact with children. Sir Roger Singleton, the chairman of the Independent Safeguarding Authority, said the scope of the planned database could increase significantly because companies would fear losing business if they did not have their employees vetted. Last month, he asked the government to look again at the complex definitions of frequent and intensive contact, following concerns that the scheme would lead to state supervision of all relationships between adults and children.
This is obviously pretty totalitarian stuff, and some would say it's overdone, but this is the direction that the law is going in. And whilst they were criticised at the time for going too far, they don't appear to have stepped back from that because, according to their website, that policy is still in operation.